This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, wherever they live, but also certainly important to all the people of the world. As you know, there is a catastrophe, a monumental war crime that's going on in Lebanon today. We had a terrible massacre at Qana, and unfortunately, Americans must take responsibility for this massacre because we have given Israel the green light to commit these terrible crimes of aggression. The media control and the media manipulation by the Jewish supremacists continues every day. I just saw a CNN broadcast this morning talking about how that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, in northeastern Lebanon, far from Israel's border, quote, arrested militants in Lebanon and killed a bunch of civilians in the process, by the way. Isn't it interesting? When Israeli soldiers are captured or killed, they are, quote, kidnapped. When Israel goes and attacks other people, kidnaps other people, puts them in their prisons and tortures them, then it's, what's the word, arrested? Ladies and gentlemen, it's just amazing. This whole war was begun because Hezbollah captured some Israeli soldiers. And this is a legitimate response. People must go back to the origin of this entire conflict. Hezbollah began because of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, an invasion and a brutal occupation that cost the lives of 20,000 Lebanese civilians, destroyed 100,000 homes. Israel presided over the horrible massacre at Sabra and Shatila. Israel committed war crime after war crime after war crime in this area. That's where Hezbollah came from. Hezbollah came as a result of Israeli terror. It's not a terrorist organization. It was a response to Israeli illegal occupation of Lebanon. An offense, by the way, the same offense that we justified going to war against Saddam Hussein because he invaded Kuwait. Well, Israel did it in Lebanon, and they were far more brutal than anything that the Iraqis could dream up. Ladies and gentlemen, it's just an amazing scenario that we have right now in the Middle East, and it brings to life the issues and the ideas that are represented in my book, Jewish Supremacism. And right now I'm doing a recorded, spoken word version of the book. Today I'm on chapter 6, and this is very applicable to what is happening today. This chapter is called Jewish Political Supremacy, and it's a slice of time, actually, from the Clinton administration. You know, a book is, in a sense, frozen in time. But don't think a lot of the principles here don't apply to today, because of course they do, and the Jewish neocons have dominated American foreign policy, you know, quite steadily for much of the last century, and certainly heavily control it in this century. The most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. is AIPAC, and they continue to disregard the best interests of the United States and America in manipulating American policy. For instance, the invasion of Lebanon is something that will damage America greatly in the future. It was certainly against every American interest. There were 25,000 Americans in Lebanon doing business, living there, teaching there, working there, and Israel attacked this country even while Americans were still in harm's way. Well, anyway, this next chapter is chapter 6, Jewish Political Supremacy. I will begin by giving you some of the quotations, very powerful quotations, at the beginning of the chapter. And I always like to use the words of other people to make my points for me, people who I guess are far more influential than I am and far more well known and respected. Quote, "The United States has no longer a government of goyim, Gentiles, but an administration in which the Jews are full partners in the decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the aspects of the Jewish religious law connected with the term government of Goyim should be re-examined, since it is an outdated term in the United States. That's from the major Israeli newspaper, Maariv. Quote, I've never seen a president, I don't care who he is, stand up to the Jews. They always get what they want. The Israelis know what's going on all the time. I got to the point where I wouldn't write anything down. If the American people understood what a grip these people have got on our government, they would rise up in arms. That was from Admiral Thomas Moore, former chairman of the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff. And this is a quotation from U.S. Secretary of State John Foster Dulles. Quote, the terrific control the Jews have over the news media and the barrage the Jews have built up on congressmen, I'm very much concerned over the fact that the Jewish influence here is completely dominating the scene and making it almost impossible to get Congress to do anything they don't approve of. The Israeli embassy is practically dictating to the Congress through influential Jewish people in the country. In recounting my learning about the Jewish power in the government of the United States, I will skip ahead about 5 years to an event I saw on television on April 15, 1973. Senator William Fulbright appeared on CBS Face the Nation. When, in discussing American policy in the Mideast, he stated very simply, Israel controls the United States Senate. Since the middle of the 1960s, I knew enough about the pro-Zionist policy of the U.S. government to realize that what he said was true. But I was shocked that he would say such a thing openly. I wondered what impact such a charge would make on the public. After all, he made one of the most sensational charges ever spoken by a United States senator, an allegation with incredible implications, that a foreign power controlled the highest legislative body of America. In a matter of just a few days, Fulbright's accusation of Zionist control disappeared from the press almost as if it had never happened. However, Senator Fulbright, a popular personage in his home state, who had been reelected easily even during the highest patriotic passions of the Vietnam War, he came to oppose the war, suddenly he found himself in hot water. In his next election, he paid dearly for his truth-telling. Huge amounts of Jewish money poured into Arkansas to defeat him, and Jews with any position of influence in business, government, or media, both inside and outside of Arkansas, rallied to help Israel Firster, Dale Bumpers. One of the most remarkable aspects of the affair was that most Jews had liked Fulbright early on because he took a position on the Vietnam War that most endorsed. Jews overwhelmingly opposed the war, from the radical communists in the streets, such as Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, to the influential Jews of the New York Times and the Washington Post. Senator Fulbright dared to say that just as it was not in our true interest to be in Vietnam, neither was it in our true interest to be embroiled in the Mideast conflict. Ironically, many Jews had called Fulbright a hero for casting the lone Senate vote in the early 1950s against continuing the funding of Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy's Permanent Investigation Subcommittee. They owed him a great debt, but all of Fulbright's past support for the liberal policies of Jews meant nothing to them when he refused to pledge unquestioning subservience to Israel. By criticizing the U.S. government's policy in the Mideast, he lost his Senate seat. As I learned about the Jewish domination of the news and entertainment media in the late 1960s, I also came across copious evidence of their enormous political power. I found it to be two-headed. Obviously, through their domination of the media, they have tremendous influence on elections and on public issues. Not only can they influence the public's perceptions by weighting propaganda for or against a candidate or an issue, they can essentially determine whether certain issues will even be discussed at all. The second way they influence politics is more direct. They have become by far the most powerful players in American campaign financing. Their support is crucial to every major candidate. Those who cater to them with the most servility receive support, while support is withheld from those whom they deem less servile. They deliver great rewards for those who play along and politically annihilate those who won't. In the 1970s, I read a Wall Street Journal article entitled American Jews and Jimmy Carter by James M. Perry. He wrote, quote, Jews are generous with their money. The White House's Mr. Siegel, a longtime Jewish employee of the Democratic National Committee, estimates that as much as 80% of the big gifts that sustain the party year in and year out come from Jews. Another article in the Wall Street Journal about campaign financing frankly stated that most of the money of the Democratic Party came from Jewish contributors, and half of the Republican war chest came from Jews as well. Campaign contributions to politicians are like oxygen. They are necessary for political life. Is there anyone who thinks that such money does not buy influence? Because Jewish money and organized Jewish support are so essential, Jewish advisors and assistants also become absolutely vital. Not long after Senator Fulbright's statement claiming Jewish control of the Senate, the highest-ranking military officer in the United States of America, General George Brown, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke candidly at Duke University about Jewish control of the American government, media, and economy. Quote, we have the Israelis coming to us for equipment. We can say we can't possibly get the Congress to support a program like this. And they say, don't worry about the Congress. We'll take care of the Congress. Now, this is somebody from another country, but they can do it. They own, you know, the banks in this country, the newspapers. Just look where the Jewish money is. Unquote. As I discussed in my chapter on Jewish group strategy, they ethnocentrically support each other until they come to dominate most organizations that they are brought into. Such is also true of the American government, from the advisory roles of Bernard Baruch and Louis Brandeis to President Woodrow Wilson to the complete domination of Bill Clinton's National Security Council. Jewish power has grown steadily as the century has drawn to a close. My awakening to Jewish power came in the mid-1960s, during the administrations of Johnson and Nixon. During the Johnson era, I was particularly aware of Wilbur Cohen, who was head of the Health, Education, and Welfare Department, was pushing forced racial integration and the baby factory welfare system that I saw as an inevitable disaster for America. I also knew that Zionist partisan Walt Rostow was one of Johnson's chief foreign advisors, as well as the ambassador to the United Nations, Arthur Goldberg. Despite Richard Nixon's supposedly cryptic anti-Semitic views as exposed by the Watergate tapes, he feared their power and readily placated it. He surrounded himself with high-level Jewish advisors and cabinet members. He made Henry Kissinger Secretary of State and appointed James Schlesinger as Secretary of Defense. Both positions are critically important to Israel. In the economic realm, he appointed Arthur Burns, chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, Herbert Stein as chief economic advisor, Lawrence Silberman as deputy attorney general, and Leonard Garment as legal counsel and head of the White House Civil Rights Department. The Zionists covered all their bases, as they usually do, by also having key positions in the inner circles of the other party. Hubert Humphrey's closest advisor, E.F. Berman, and Humphrey's 11 largest contributors were Jews. George McGovern's top advisor was Frank Mankiewicz. Now, by the way, on this documentation, you can go to Jewish Supremacism and you will find the direct citations that back up what I say. After Nixon's resignation, Gerald Ford kept Henry Kissinger and brought in an old Stalinist sympathizer, Edward Levy, as attorney general. And he named Alan Greenspan as his chief economic advisor, who later, of course, became head of the Federal Reserve until replaced recently by another Jewish appointee. Now, that's across both Republicans and Democratic lines. Jimmy Carter continued the disproportionate Jewish representation by appointing Harold Brown as Secretary of Defense and adding a troop of the chosen to the National Security Council and important economic positions. Reagan and Bush added to the Jewish onslaught with the appointment of a host of other Jews to positions throughout the bureaucracy, always reserving many key roles for Jews in foreign and economic policy. From the early days of the 20th century, Jewish power has steadily progressed to the point where it's now breathtaking in its scope. As their power became more entrenched, the Jewish-dominated media found less need to deny its clout. In fact, they may find it somewhat to their advantage to boast of it so they can make sure that no goyim will dare challenge it. The major Israeli newspaper, Maariv, ran a story called, quote, "The Jews Who Run Clinton's Court" on September 2, 1994, in which it boasted of the dominant Jewish makeup of Clinton's advisors and cabinet. It quotes a prominent Washington rabbi to the effect that the government of the United States is no longer a government of Gentiles. It bears repeating, quote, "The U.S. has no longer a government of goyim, Gentiles, but an administration in which the Jews are full partners in a decision-making at all levels. Perhaps the aspects of the Jewish religious law connected with the term governor goyim should be reexamined. It's just an outdated term in the United States." In other words, my friends, it's no longer a government of us, it's a government of them. The article boasts of their complete domination of the administration and describes many top officials around the president as, quote, "warm Jews," unquote, upon whom Israel can always count. And here's a direct quote from the article. "In the National Security Council, 7 out of the 11 top staffers are Jews. Clinton had especially placed them in the most sensitive junctions in the U.S. security and foreign administrations. Sandy Berger is the deputy chairman of the council. Martin Indyk, the intended ambassador to Israel, is the senior director in charge of the Middle East and South Asia. Dan Shifter, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Western Europe. Don Steinberg, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Africa. Richard Feinberg, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Latin America. Stanley Ross, the senior director and advisor to the president, is in charge of Asia. The situation is not much different in the president's office, which is full of warm Jews. The new attorney general, Abner Beatfi, the president's schedule and programs manager, Ricky Seldman, deputy chief of staff, Phil Lida, economic advisor, Robert Rubin, media director, David Helzer, staff director, Alice Rubin, Ely Siegel, in charge of volunteers, Ira Mezina, in charge of the health program, two cabinet members, Labor Secretary Robert Reich and Mickey Cantor, in charge of international trade agreements, are Jewish. They are joined by a long list of senior Jewish officials in the State Department, headed by the head of Middle East Peace Team, Dennis Ross, and followed by many deputy secretaries and even more senior secretaries, chiefs of staff. Dennis Ross, by the way, of course, was the chief negotiator at Camp David. That deal they said the Palestinians should have taken, which was a horrible deal, moderated or negotiated and refereed by Dennis Ross, the man mentioned here, a warm Jew who's 100% in favor of Israel. You know, in most soccer matches or most football matches in the United States, you never have referees representing the other team or from the other home team's turf. And yet, somehow, we're supposed to have good mediation in the Middle East by having radical Jewish supremacists being the negotiators. Let's go on. Bar Yosef begins the article by pointing out that these warm Jews, dedicated Zionists, who every day go over the most secret intelligence information presented to the President of the United States. One wonders why Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard is locked up in federal prison when extreme partisans for Israel, such as Sandy Berger, have daily access to America's most secret intelligence. Even in my college days, it was obvious to many people that the Jewish lobby had a tremendous impact on Capitol Hill and in the White House. A real dichotomy existed between what the politicians would do and what they would say. Even though Nixon ran on a conservative platform which emphasized issues such as victory in Vietnam and opposition to forced busing, his administration began the first affirmative action programs. Although he gave lip service to ending busing for racial integration, he appointed the officers of the Attorney General's office who continued to push for it in courts across America. His Jewish Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger, helped frame the Paris Peace Accords that led to the inevitable victory of the Viet Cong and a peace with dishonor, making meaningless the sacrifices of hundreds of thousands of American fighting men. Interestingly, many of the same dovish voices decrying the napalming of Viet Cong soldiers were Israeli hawks, cheering the use of the same weapons on women and children in the Palestinian refugee camps. The Israeli newspaper also makes it clear that effective Jewish control includes both Democrats and Republicans. Quote, "Incidentally, although the Jewish power in the current Democratic administration is so huge, there are also many warm Jews heading the top positions of the Republican Party. And of course, and that's unquote, and of course we've seen that recently, as a side note, not from the book. We've seen that obviously in the creation of the Iraq War, a war for Israel, not for America. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of part one of chapter six from Jewish Supremacism. The chapter title is Jewish Political Supremacy. And tomorrow I will continue explaining and talking about the role and the incredible power of these Jewish extremists in the government and the policies of the United States of America. I hope all of you listening will certainly support our efforts. You can contact us directly at Box 188, Mandeville, Louisiana, 70470, or through our website, davidduke.com. We need your support. I need your support to continue this work. This is free. I hope you'll continue to help spread the word on this spoken word form of the book, Jewish Supremacism. Thanks so much. I look forward to being with you again tomorrow. This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.